But what I like to do in those moments is expunge myself of any bias with respect to money that's been spent and just try and make a decision with fresh eyes. How much capital do we have and what are the decisions with the information we have right now? Irrespective of capital that's already been spent. That's how we make a lot of our critical decisions, because sometimes the right thing to do is to pursue a path that maybe is suboptimal from a product perspective, but you want to do that unbiased by sunk cost fallacy, right? You don't want to be constrained by, I made a mistake and now I'm going to do this because I want to cover up my mistake.
Welcome to MedCider, where you can learn from the brightest founders and CEOs in medical devices and health technology. Join tens of thousands of ambitious doers as we unpack the insights, tactics, and secrets behind the most successful life science startups in the world. Now, here's your host, Scott Nelson.
Hey everyone, it's Scott. In this episode of MedCider, I sat down with Benjamin Sexson, president and CEO of Monogram Orthopedics. Ben is a mechanical engineer from Caltech and a CFA charter holder. And at Monogram, him and his team are developing a fully autonomous robotic system for knee replacement surgery. Here are a few of the key things that we discussed in this conversation. First, avoid the sunk cost fallacy. Don't let past investments cloud your judgment about a project's present viability. Regularly assess the viability of your idea based on current conditions, not past investments. Be willing to pivot towards a better solution, even if it's difficult. Maintaining a steadfast belief in your work is crucial, and without it, your ability to overcome challenges and effectively communicate your vision will be compromised. Second, finding the right funding source is tricky, especially for early stage startups. Consider alternative routes like crowdfunding or IPOs. Be aware that both options have their challenges. Crowdfunding requires a strong marketing push, and IPOs can create administrative headaches. Thoroughly evaluate your specific needs, but don't be afraid to iterate as you move forward. Third, MedTech is a team sport. A strong support system and an A-plus team are a must. Find talented people who are willing to shoulder responsibility with you through the tough times and who are able to set aside their egos. Maintain a company culture where everyone is heard and there's no punishment in raising one's opinion, even if it proves out to be wrong. All right, before we jump into this episode, I wanted to let you know that the latest edition of MedCider Mentors is now live. We just published Volume 5, which summarizes the key learnings from the most popular MedCider interviews over the last several months with incredible entrepreneurs like Gabriel Jones, CEO of Proprio, Kirsten Carroll, CEO of Can Do Health, Dr. David Alpert, founder of AliveCore, Greg Bullington, CEO of Magnolia Medical, and other leaders of some of the hottest startups in our space. Look, it's tough to listen or read every interview that comes out, even the best ones, but there are so many valuable lessons you can pick up from the founders and CEOs that join our program. So that's why we decided to create MedCider Mentors. It's the easiest way for you to learn from the world's best medical device and health technology entrepreneurs in one central place. To check out the latest volume, head over to MedCiderRadio.com/mentors. Premium members get free access to all past and future volumes. If you're not a premium member yet, you should definitely consider signing up. In addition to every volume of MedCider Mentors, you'll get full access to the entire library of interviews dating back to 2010. You'll also be able to see all of our playbooks, which are handpicked collections of the most insightful interviews with the brightest founders and CEOs that join our program. Whether you're looking to master capital fundraising, navigate early stage development, tackle regulatory challenges, understand reimbursement, or position your venture for a meaningful exit, MedCider playbooks have you covered. And last, considering that fundraising can be one of the most daunting tasks for any startup, we created a meticulous database of investors right at your fingertips. Explore a wealth of VC funds, private equity firms, angel groups, and more, all eager to invest in medical device and health technology startups. Access to this database is a premium member exclusive, so don't miss out. Learn more about MedCider Mentors and our premium memberships by visiting MedCiderRadio.com/mentors. All right, without further ado, let's jump into the interview. All right, Ben, welcome to MedCider Radio. Appreciate you coming on, man.
Scott, great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Looking forward to the conversation. Have been like loosely kind of following your story with Monogram, you know, over the past several years. So excited to kind of dive a little bit deeper to learn not only about your background, but your journey building a company so far. So with that said, let's spend the first, you know, 5 or 10 minutes of the conversation talking a little bit about yourself kind of leading up to Monogram. And then we'll touch on maybe your technology at a high level before we you know, kind of go back in time and learn a little bit more about kind of your experiences across kind of some cross-functional areas. So let's start first, though. I recorded, you know, a very brief bio at the outset of this episode, like I typically do. But I, you know, let's hear it from kind of the horse's mouth, so to speak. Give, you know, if you can give us sort of an elevator style pitch of your background before taking on the CEO role at Monogram, that'd be great.
Sure. So thanks again for the opportunity. So my background is pretty tech heavy. I'm an engineer by background, pretty nerdy. I would describe myself as kind of a Moses style leader, reluctant leader. My first love is building products. This is kind of has become a passion project at this point. Going into it, I wouldn't have called myself an orthopedic expert. I had a lot of passion for robotics, for innovative manufacturing methods like 3D printing, and meeting Dr. Yunus, who is our founder. He's a practicing orthopedic surgeon. I would say that I started to have some understanding of what he was trying to do and why it was compelling. But honestly, it probably wasn't until about 3 to 4 years into building, seeing knee after knee after knee, that I really started to understand why this was a must-have product. I would say that we started out with what seemed to be a very intuitive value proposition, combining 3D printing and custom implants with robotics, which is kind of a no-brainer innovation that anybody would sort of understand, think makes sense. As I've gotten more and more into the weeds, I've started to realize that where we are with robotics today is not where we need to be. I've been in operating rooms now. I've seen surgeries that have not gone well. And I've come to understand that surgeons really do need to be using robotics, just generally. It's not only just robotics plus implants, but just robotics themselves. And now it's become really my life's mission. This has to get to the operating room. We need this technology to be used in the operating room. It's going in our my strong opinion, obviously, this is not validated with clinical data, but I've seen enough in the cadaver lab to say I think this is going to make a difference for patients. And so, you know, my background is engineering. You know, I have to give credit where credit's due. I know there might be some startup founders listening. The company wouldn't exist without my wife, who's been an important part of this. You know, without help, Monogram wouldn't have existed. So there was a period for about 2 years where she was basically funding our lifestyle, which was not very extravagant, while I was not getting paid to do this. So for anybody listening, just want to encourage you, try and find a partner or somebody who you're working with who will help support what you're trying to do. So I would say that in some ways, we're a partnership. Dr. Yunus, who's not on this, is also been really instrumental to the success of this. And now we've built a team of 27 full-time employees who are also really critical to this mission. So I would be reluctant to just kind of point at myself and say what's special about me. I think where I've been helpful for the company is to help keep things focused on the mission, help focus on the product, making sure the product is actually meeting an acute pain point, and then helping to kind of pull together a team that has a culture of building and not a culture of dividing. And I've gone a lot of directions there, Scott. Sorry for, I opened up a lot of rabbit holes, which I no tend worries. To do, but.
No, it's all good. Yeah. I appreciate you calling out your wife, especially. I mean, it's one of the things that oftentimes goes underappreciated, right? With in kind of the startup story where, you know, your partner, whether you're married, spouse, et cetera, plays such an instrumental role. You know what I mean?
Massive role.
Yeah.
Massive,
if things aren't smooth on the home front, things will typically not be very smooth on the professional front. You know what I mean? So,
I just like to say that because a lot of times it's like, founders, it's like, oh, it's all about me. But almost every time I've met an entrepreneur, there has been some help, whether or not they recognize it or not, and some good fortune along the way. And we've had a lot of that with our company. And so just have to call that out. You know, we've had people that I think joined Monogram. They could have worked at a lot of places. We have some of the most talented engineers, I think, in the world. And these are experts where if you were looking for an expert, for example, in, you know, robotics, like these are not pools of candidates with thousands of people. These are pools of candidates with, you know, tens of people. And we've been able to recruit some very, very smart people who are dedicated to the mission. So have to shout out to all of those guys.
No, I like it. And I'm looking at the website now, which is monogramorthopedics.com. If you're listening and don't get to the full write-up on MedCider, it's monogram, MONOGRAM, orthopedics.com. Very cool website, by the way. And I'm looking at the Emboss platform specifically. And, you know, for those listening that, you know, maybe have heard of Monogram or maybe even haven't heard the company at all, and whether it's, you know, they're loosely familiar or not familiar at all, give us like a high level overview of kind of how your technology is, you know, differentiated, you know, versus other orthopedic options, or robotics in general. Where does Monogram fit kind of in the broader, you know, med tech landscape?
Sure. So I'll start with like, kind of the elephant in the room, which is our biggest criticism when people want to kind of, hate on Monogram. The biggest thing people say is, well, this has already been done. You guys are late to the party. You know, this is just another kind of me too robot. And what's tough, Scott, is that you really have to start to drill into the details of the surgery, to really understand what's actually different here. So we're not just taking a OEM KUKA arm and, you know, doing robotic surgery with it. We really thought about it from a different perspective, which is, what are the biggest pain points that matter to surgeons and patients? And I'll just give you kind of one example of those. We're working on a paper right now that's going to be a comparative head-to-head study looking at the planned tensioned laxity, and apologies if this is a little technical, but of other systems on the market versus our system. So we're focusing on, let's say, accuracy where it actually matters, and where it actually matters is my plan matching the outcome? And most robots today aren't thinking about the surgery as a soft tissue surgery. They're thinking about it as a bone cutting surgery, which is really fundamentally flawed. So our system is designed to be incredibly accurate where it actually matters. Our system is fully autonomous. So there isn't really any robot on the market today that's widely adopted that's autonomous. And what does that mean? It means that the surgeon isn't actually moving the arm around or doing a lot of work. Really, what we think is that ultimately this is going to be creative destruction. We think that knee replacements should not really be a bottleneck for surgeons. Surgeons who, let's say, are really skilled and really smart, we don't think they should be spending their time worrying about knee replacements 10 years from now. This is a solved problem, and let's get those creative people out of knee replacements and put them into other places in the economy where they can be more productive. Maybe they should be worrying about spine or something else where there's a problem. So our robot is really commoditizing the industry. Where the problem has been for robotics is that robotics to date have not solved the economic problem. So Mako has addressed a lot of clinical needs, and that's why they have 90% market share in orthopedic robotics, but it's an incremental cost basically to everybody in the system. It takes more time for the surgeon to use the Mako robot. It adds incremental cost to the hospital. There's more consumables. You need a CT scan. There's all of these extra things. And when you think about robotics are supposed to kind of commoditize things. They're supposed to increase throughput at a lower cost. And so nobody's actually figured out how to do that. And that's our mission. Our mission is to solve the clinical problem, but also make the operating room, at least starting with knee replacements, commoditized, where there's really low to no skill required and throughput is increased dramatically and incremental cost goes down. That's our vision. And I think we're on a trajectory that will allow us to execute that mission.
Got it. That's really helpful. And I'm looking at kind of some recent news kind of within the Monogram ecosystem, per se. And I think I saw that your first sale to a major, a major global distributor kind of occurred sort of the tail end of 2023 last year. So give us a sense, are you actively kind of commercializing the emboss system now? Give us a kind of a high level overview of kind of where you're at in the life cycle of the company.
Sure. So, our focus market has always been the US. It's by far the lion's share of where the money is right now in orthopedics. But there's also a very significant opportunity overseas. And from a clinical perspective, I would say the opportunity might even be more acute than it is here in the US. You have not enough surgeons, and you know, in the US, one of the things that we, I think, have done a really good job of is kind of really thinking about what the best way to do a knee replacement is. And we have really solid training and so forth. And I think in some markets, there's just not enough surgeons to meet the demand. So we think outside the US is a very attractive opportunity from a clinical standpoint and also from a regulatory standpoint. So, for good reason, the FDA is pretty tough. They certainly can make it difficult to get products to market. I would say that we have had a really, really positive actually interactions with the agency. Our most recent discussion with them occurred in December, and it was very helpful, and it related to strategies around what we need to do to get to market here in the US. And so our goal is kind of twofold. One is, if there's opportunities overseas, we want to go after them. And then secondly, if there's opportunities to get clinical data overseas, we want to pursue those. And we want to try and leverage that with our communications with the FDA. Hopefully we think that could be helpful for those discussions. At the end of the day, the FDA's biggest concern is, is your system, once you can approve equivalence, is it actually safe? And so we're thinking of ways to show them that our system is safe, potentially leveraging overseas data.
Very good. I want to definitely kind of double click into that regulatory topic here in a few minutes. First, let's spend the next 20 or 30 minutes kind of running through some of these different kind of functional areas, because I'd love to get kind of your not only your input, but maybe, talk about some of the lessons you learned or insights that you've gleaned, over the last five or 6 years building Monogram. The first question on the list is typically where I like to start is kind of design and development, right? I'm sure that the platform, the system looks a lot different now versus, back in, 2017, 18, when you started working on the project or the company. So when you think about kind of how you've moved through kind of design and development from, concepts to alpha to beta, et cetera, have there been a few kind of key things that you've learned along the way? Because this is often, one of the most challenging things early on for startups, especially when you're typically pretty capital constrained, right? How do you make compelling progress with limited funds, right? On your kind of your way through that development lifecycle?
I absolutely love this question. One of my management philosophies is never look back, right? So, and what I mean by that is, don't make decisions based on like a sunk cost fallacy, where let's say you put capital into something and you realize it's not going to be a good product, it's not going to work for whatever reasons, and now there's a critical decision that needs to be made, which is, do we continue on this path and do something that we no longer believe in, or do we stop and say we're always going to do the right thing, even if it hurts? And this is a very tough thing to do. But what I like to do in those moments is expunge myself of any bias with respect to money that's been spent, and just try and make a decision with fresh eyes. How much capital do we have, and what are the decisions with the information we have right now, irrespective of capital that's already been spent? And that's how we make a lot of our critical decisions, because sometimes the right thing to do is to pursue a path that maybe is suboptimal from a product perspective, but you want to do that unbiased by sunk sunk cost fallacy, right? You don't want to be constrained by, I made a mistake and now I'm going to do this because I want to cover up my mistake. Better to always be honest, own your mistakes. That's part of R&D. Part of R&D is to figure out what doesn't work and always move forward with what does work. So I'll give you the perfect example of this because we had to make a very critical decision. We started out using a rotary tool and effector. And actually the first company that has an autonomous system, Think Surgical, uses a rotary tool. And what we realized over time is that there's actually like physics constraints to how fast you can cut with a rotary tool. So one of the problems you have with a rotary tool, just as one example, is that because the burr is spinning so fast, it heats up the bone. And so you have constraints on what the feed rate can actually be before you start basically cooking the bone, which is really bad for the patient. And so we, you know, these are things that you kind of only learn as you're doing R&D and you kind of, they're non-issues, but then you start trying to push the envelope and they become issues. And so you can start going down rabbit holes of, you know, maybe we mess with the burr geometry, maybe we do this, maybe and it becomes, you get to a point where you're like, what is the optimized end case for this? Is that a good product? And the answer is no. And then you have a decision where it's like, do I do what's right for investors, where I really, you know, whatever I'm selling, I want to believe in? Or do I want to just try and get something out the door to say I have 510K approval? You get to these points where you kind of know the truth. And so at that point, we had to make a decision. What do? We don't have a product we believe in. Like fundamentally, if we're not faster than, or at least competitive with Mako, we don't have a product we can believe in. So we looked at all of the options, and one of the options we'd always kind of thrown around was, can we use a sagittal saw instead of a rotary tool? And we had talked to a number of robotic experts who had told us that it was impossible for a number of kind of complicated reasons. And we really dug into like, what is it about that that's impossible? And what would it take to pivot to a whole different cutting system? And we ultimately made a decision to pivot. And it was very risky. It took us a lot of effort to make it work. Basically a lot of what had been developed on the rotary tool end effector, we just had to kind of say, well, this was R&D. And now we have a system, Scott, it crushes. I mean, we haven't done a public release, but we're now actively cutting without external fixation in phenomenal cut times that can be even further optimized. Like we actually have something that we all believe is the best robot in the world. We actually believe it. Whereas before we would have been pushing something we didn't believe in. And I am fully happy to accept that mistake. We made the best decision we had with the information we had, and then we got new information and we realized that all of our kind of presuppositions, some of them were wrong in light of the new information. And now we needed to make a decision with the new information. So the way I think about it is almost like owning a stock. I'll tell you what a lot of people kind of do wrong when they own a stock, right? A lot of times I think about things in terms of like an investing mindset. Let's say you own a stock and it has a dividend yield today. It's paying a dividend of whatever, $1. And it's a $20 stock. And so you have a 5% dividend yield. And that stock, let's say it doubles to $40. A lot of what people will do in their mind is they'll still think that they have a 5% dividend yield. It's like, no, now you have a stock that's yielding 2.5%. And you need to think about it with fresh eyes of, is this worth owning? Don't think about what you had right now today. What you have, it's changed fundamentally. You could sell that and put that into something else that's yielding 5%, right? So you kind of have to think about everything in terms of, where am I right now? What's all the information I have right now? And what's the best decision right now? Not what happened. And that's how we kind of try and run things. One of the entrepreneurs that I really look up to, Elon Musk, there's a pretty interesting story that he has at SpaceX, where they were trying some like novel manufacturing method for developing like the nose cone, I think it was. And they put some astronomical amount of money into this, and they were just struggling. And he was just like, nope, pivot, we're going to the next thing. And that's R&D. We're not going to sit and cry over the money that's been spent, because every time we spend money, we're trying to do the ethical thing. As long as you are ethical with the money you're spending and you're always trying to do the right thing, then that's R&D. And so that's how I think about it. And that's how I think we have a huge advantage over our competitors, because it's very difficult for large companies to do this, right? When a large company has too many cooks in the kitchen and they have, you know, 20,000 stakeholders and all of these different divisions, it takes a very, very special manager to say, I'm going to make all of you upset and say the decision that was made here was the wrong one. And this money that we spent trying to push this, you know, product that's no good, that, you know, a lot of companies are really frantically trying to push turds, and they're like, No, this is great. They're trying to make everybody believe it's great. And a big reason is they've spent too much money trying to, and they're unwilling to say we're wrong and we're going to do what's right.
Yeah. Cause if they do, their career is not career, but definitely their job is on the line. Right. They're not likely going to be promoted after that. And will be kind of silenced. Their opinion is going to matter very little, like, moving forward. And that ultimately spells for most people kind of a need to kind of move on. Right. And so to stare that down is really hard. Difficult. Yeah. I'm really glad you brought this up, Ben, because it's actually, I'm trying to remember the last time maybe someone, another founder, and maybe it's because of your engineering background kind of combined with your finance experience, you know, that allows you to kind of think with a fresh lens. But that decision that you made, like even the example that you shared, it's easy to kind of look back and think, yeah, that was a difficult decision. But I can't imagine, like, in the moment, like, how difficult that really was. Because
it was, yes. Yeah. I mean, we had a lot of problems. Let me take, like, but...
Hey there, it's Scott, and thanks for listening in so far. The rest of this conversation is only available via our private podcast for MedSider Premium members. If you're not a premium member yet, you should definitely consider signing up. You'll get full access to the entire library of interviews dating back to 2010. This includes conversations with experts like Renee Ryan, CEO of Cala Health, Nadeem Yared, CEO of CVRX, and so many others. As a premium member, you'll get to join live interviews with these incredible medical device and health technology entrepreneurs. In addition, you'll get a copy of every volume of MedSider Mentors at no additional cost. To learn more, head over to MedSiderRadio.com/premium. Again, that's MedSiderRadio.com/premium.